Well, it's good to be gathered together this evening, and if young people are the way they were in my day, you didn't overdo this subject, or you didn't talk about it too much as a general rule. And so I do look forward to having some having you involved as well. Obviously, it's a subject that that is of interest to about all ages. And Solomon, excuse me. Solomon in Proverbs 30:19 talks about four things that he wonders about. And he said, yea, the fourth one he just can't know, and that one was the way of the man with the maid. Not sure what all he was saying. But at any rate, he was admitting that there is mystery involved when it comes to how the genders relate to each other. Find it providential that on Sunday we had such a good topic again, such a good message again on singlehood. And that precedes this evening's topic on courtship is, I don't think, is an accident. I'm not sure why the Lord provided it that way, but I think it's perhaps to bring some balance to ahead of time, to maybe the things that we want to talk about this evening. When... what's your name?
Daryl.
A 58-year-olds can have mental blocks too. When Daryl called me and said he's going to be reading from Genesis, the story about Isaac and Rebekah, I had assumed it would be a much longer story than it was. That is a story of a lot of intrigue. It's a lot of interest. And he said it right, that it appears to have been pretty much a business deal. Obviously, not only did Isaac bathe it in prayer, so did Eliezer. And if I get nothing else across this evening than that, I think that that is one of the most important ingredients in courtship, in preparing for and in leading to. Isaac was out in the field when the caravan of camels came, and it reminded me that in my day, when I was contemplating this young lady from Indiana, I would go across the fields to Alvin's field in the dark. And there I would take time to think and pray, just walking and just enjoying the out of doors and somehow connecting with God and thinking of who this person might be, or that she might someday be my wife. And so I think that contemplation, meditation are always are generally a fairly important part of at least fellas' effort at finding a spouse. And probably for girls, there's a lot of time going into prayer. I'd urge you to do that, to give it to the Lord. And I just recognize that it is very different for young men than it is for young ladies. And yet, the thing that we want to keep track of as more than anything else is that we have a God over us that watches, and a God that cares, a God who is very seriously interested in the details of your lives. One of the things about courtship is that it never loses its intrigue, even in this day. It, like I mentioned, for Solomon, it was pretty important. And even today, the people that run the grapevine seem to be more eager to run to tell that news than about anything else that you can get on it. And it's a part of it. And married people get excited about hearing about new romances, even though they know that being married takes work. And I always find that interesting, because to me it is an evidence of how, of something that God has created, that God has planned for man and woman to live together in harmony for many years, to live faithfully with each other. Obviously, the excitement that surrounds courtship is not just something that is peculiar to our tradition, but it is something that is enjoyed in most cultures. I admit that as I observe other cultures, I recognize that there are many situations that are very disappointing. You observe our own culture, and you just realize that there is a reason why we talk about godly courtship, because there are other kinds of courtship as well. There are two general categories of courtship there may be more than that, but two that I can think of easily is what is called an arranged marriage or an arranged courtship, and one that is called a love courtship. And there's a lot of variations between, and sometimes a good bit of overlap between the two. And we're not here really to debate the value or the importance of either one. I just recognize that God can use them both. I did find out in some of our travels that sometimes the arranged marriages aren't quite the way that you think they are. Our friend Chauhan from India, for example, rejected his father's first attempt. His father and the father of a young lady made an attempt at arranging a marriage that Chauhan was not interested in. And they respected his wishes. And later then, Chauhan found Surabhi, who he really did want. Then he talked to his dad about it. And the fathers still arranged the marriage, but it was intentional. And if we have time at the end, I might tell you another story about Chauhan and his wedding that bears out some of the challenges and difficulties of any kind of any perfect union. I imagine if we could get it as clear as what Isaac and Eliezer got it as to who we are to marry, young men, it would seem pretty simple. Generally, it doesn't work that way. In my case, it was sort of a matter of time. There was the moment that I remember that I first got the idea, and it never left me after that. And it took some time to get it accomplished, but it was worth the wait. And I won't take your time to tell you my story tonight. One of the things that I would like to recognize is that in our culture, that there has been a shift in courtships over the past. Well, I think maybe it's true. Maybe it's fair to say that there has been sort of a transition for years, and probably courtship and how it is done evolves from generation to generation. Many of our parents would remember courtships that they couldn't have approved of, and they did some things different. And then a generation later, there was a little different approach to courtship. And when I was the age of these young men down here, it was different than it is now, in that typically there would be, you wouldn't start out with quite the bang that they do now. You would start out by not casual dating, not casual in the sense that it didn't matter. That had happened earlier, maybe some, but by the time I came along, it was more. You did a little bit of experimental dating, maybe that'd be what you call it, and if you had serious interest in a girl, you would date for a while, and then at some point, when it really seemed to work, why, you called it going steady. Now, you may or your parents may or may not have told you that, but that's the way it worked back then. And then, of course, after that, if that worked out, then there was engagement and marriage. Today, interestingly enough, a young man typically asks the father of the young lady for permission to ask her, or then may even ask the father to ask for him. In my case, I asked Susanna's dad if I could marry her, but that was the first time I asked his permission for anything. And I rather like the shift that I've seen to fathers, to parents being involved early on. Found out after I'd asked him that question, that someone of the extended family said what a disappointment that would be to have my dad know before I know that my boyfriend is going to ask me to marry me. And so we just acknowledge there's been that shift. And so I do encourage that. I do think that there is a lot of value in that. I'm going to, just at the risk here of telling you how I feel and maybe having you guess how smart I am, I'm wondering if there wouldn't be room for sometimes a couple does not know each other well, where there can be a time of not quite as serious a commitment to it, to dating, as we sometimes make it. And I know that may be a little tough to sell. I'm not talking about something that's careless. I am talking about something that allows people the room and some space to get acquainted, to get to know each other, and to get to understand better the Lord's design for their lives. Now, having said that, though, let me tell you again that I applaud and I honor, I just appreciate and respect what has become the custom for us here. And I think even in society, perhaps more generally. Would you turn with me to Genesis chapter 1 for a basis on courtship? I'm going to ask someone to read Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and 27. Anyone who finds it, go ahead and read it. Thank you, Dwight. Now, this is on the heels of having created the animals, having created the creatures. Let me actually just tell you what I'm up to right now. I'd like to lay a little bit of a basis for relationships. And so I'd like to involve you. I'd like to keep you involved as much as I can here. But here we have Here we have, following the creation of the animals, the creatures, that God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and so forth. Now, can you tell me what was different about man from the animals? Yeah, from these two verses.
He created in God's image.
Okay, he was created in God's image. That's an important point. Now, there's something that there's a function that he gave him that was different than the animals. What was that function?
Have dominion.
He was to have dominion. All right. So, in essence, we have become like God, or we have been created in His image and in His likeness. But in function, He has given us a certain kind of dominion. Now, dominion could have two meanings. One would be more the control, the power over. But dominion also has the idea of jurisdiction behind. It would be similar, but yet just a bit different. Now, someone read Genesis 2, verse 16 and verse 17. Go ahead.
And the Lord commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest eat freely, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat. For in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die.
Okay, what capability is implied here? It's not as plain as the word dominion, but what capability is implied here when God says you here is something that you shall not do? He was implying that they could do something different, but what was the capability he was giving man? That's right. He was given the capability of choice. Now, in this case, it was a choice between good and evil, right and wrong. Now, someone read Genesis 3, verses 12 and 13.
And the man said, the woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat. And the Lord God said unto the woman, what is this that thou hast done? And the woman said, the serpent beguiled me, and I did eat.
This one may be a little harder to ferret out of here, and I don't think I'm stretching it at all. But I'd like to, what do you see here about what's happening here with Adam and Eve, where they're sort of drawing a curtain around themselves, and they're saying it's not my fault, it's not me. What characteristic do we see here with Adam and Eve? You see, they're both saying, it's not my fault. Adam blames it on her. She blames it on the serpent.
Downright disobedience.
Well, that's right. it was downright disobedience.
Shifting blame.
Yeah. Okay, it was shifting blame. There's something else that I'd like to test you with, at least. Okay, denial of wrongdoing. And in that, they were indicating that they were individuals. In other words, they are not responsible. They created for themselves a little bit they walled themselves off from the responsibility. They walled themselves off from each other. And they basically were saying that I, as a person, am not responsible. Now, we have three things here that I'd like for us to look at. We have dominion, and we have choice, and we have individuality. And And I have had a growing interest and continue to be fascinated with how God makes us after his likeness and after his image. And I had mentioned this earlier here publicly one time, and this is not to try and hammer home a point, but I'd like for you to consider with me, if we put these three characteristics together, what attribute of God would that most closely mimic, do you think? Dominion, choice, and individuality. What part of God is that most like?
Sovereignty.
Okay, sovereignty. Did someone else have another comment? That's the one I was headed for. And it seems almost wrong for us to think of us as sovereign beings. But the reason I'm using this to sort of a springboard into courtship is because, as I see it, as I understand courtship, as I understand relationships, if we get a hold of this concept, it will help us understand a lot about the things that happen between people. Because it is true that we are not divinely sovereign. In other words, we are not sovereign like God is, who answers to absolutely no one. But would you agree with me that there is a degree of sovereignty in us that we really do answer to no one? Now, there are consequences with it. But God does not interfere with our personal choices. He allows us a kind of sovereignty that is just our own. And a man can make choices that will condemn him to eternal damnation, and God won't interfere. Now he has to suffer the consequences. So in that sense, yes, we do answer. But but in the final analysis, what we have in this little slice of sovereignty, as I call it, that God has given us, this piece of himself that he's given us, he has created us with the ability to choose. He has given us a personal space. He has given us individuality. He's given us things that are peculiar just to us. But I think it's a part of that. Now, you may ask, well, so what does that have to do with courtship? I would say quite a bit. Because, you see, everything that happens with us and other people is in some measure connected to this concept and this principle. And so when people are learning to live together, they are learning to blend these individual spheres that have for their lifetime have sort of operated independently of other people. Not completely independently, but you'll understand courtship is a very different kind of relationship than any other kind of relationship that there is. And so much of what we come to believe and how we live in courtship is learning to communicate with each other, is learning to enter into each other's sovereign worlds. Am I making sense? You see,
and Mm-hmm. That we become a more whole person or a richer person than with just going the independent or sovereign route.
That's right. And that's very helpful. I appreciate you bringing that up. Maybe there's other comments or other questions that you'd have. I realize that maybe sometimes digging like this doesn't really light our fire, but I'm more interested in stimulating your ideas and your thoughts from here out than I am just in spoon feeding you this evening. We'll get to some spoon feeding yet a little later, but the whole idea. Well, maybe I should just say it this way, that just as dominion, choice, and individuality are characteristics of sovereignty, they are also necessary elements of relationship. So it's because you have dominion of your little world, I'm going to say. And you have the right to let other people into that. You have the right, you have the ability to choose whether or not you do that. All of those things, you see, that's a necessary part of relationship. Now, here's the other thing that I would just point out. There are times that people, that we unintentionally, and sometimes intentionally, reach into someone else's sovereignty, do things that we should never have done. And we have come to know that as abuse. And it can be abuse on a variety of levels. But you see, whenever that happens, I'm going to use this word sovereignty because I don't know what else to use. Whenever our sovereignty is encroached upon, there's something that dies inside of us. Now, here's where I want to take us and where it relates to courtship. You see, let's take an arranged marriage, for example. There's a father, or there's two fathers who decide that two people are going to get married, and these two people absolutely do not want to get married. What's happening in that case? You know, we could maybe say, I think I had a hand coming up over here. Go ahead, David.
You know, I find it interesting what you're telling us, but you would probably agree that the Christian does need to surrender his sovereignty to the one who's talking the sovereign of the world.
Yes, absolutely. And I make that clear. This, what I'm talking about here is not... Is under the assumption that we are under a sovereign God, that we bend to the will of God. I do appreciate that.
But it's not that you're blessing Adam and Eve's sovereignty in that they excused themselves.
No.
It's that you're leading us to see that in order to have a relationship, we're going to have to deal with this issue of sovereignty.
That's right.
And in that, we have greater chance of respectfully inter relationships and building of something richer than we might dream otherwise.
Something that is meaningful.
Yes.
Something that we value. In the case... Go ahead.
And I should have also mentioned that when we joined the church, we gave up sovereignty.
That's right. We do this at every, I mean, it happens over and over again throughout our life. And I could, maybe just to illustrate a little what I'm trying to say here. This is not something cold and hard, and because there's a sense in which we love to give. There are times when we invite people into our sovereignty. I have grandchildren, and as much as I loved my children, I think I love my grandchildren just as much as I do them. And there is probably nothing that warms my heart more than to feel Like, they are letting me into their world, and I'm letting them into mine. So we have this craving for relationship. We have this craving for to mesh sovereign worlds. We do. It's just that the thing we have to do is respect each other's sovereign world. When a little baby is a mama baby, and a grandpa would like to hold that child ever so badly, to force himself onto that child does not win him any favor. Now, it's not sin, but it doesn't win him any favor. Now, that's just a simple example. The time comes then when that little grandchild will probably open up and will be, you know, will invite him in. But the reason that this is so pertinent to courtship is because here we're trying to bring two people together who are wanting to blend what God has created them, where God has created them as sovereign individuals. We're bringing these two people together, and they're learning to operate and mesh with each other without violating the other's sovereignty. It touches every area. It touches how you go about asking. It touches how you communicate with each other. It touches your standards. It touches a lot more than what we think of, and we'll get to something a little easier here pretty soon. But I just like for us to get a hold of the concept and the idea, so that we understand why it is that sometimes relationships are so sour. I'm not talking about courtship relationships. You know, there are times when you and I feel very safe to let somebody else in and know about ourselves. We call it being vulnerable. Or maybe that would be a little more letting myself into your world, telling you about myself. Okay? And so we break down the more these walls of sovereignty break down, the more effective we are in communicating with each other. Well, let's move on to something that's just a little bit easier now. The title of the topic is godly courtship. By implication, this title is saying that there is courtship other than godly courtship. I realize that I sort of dropped the ball on the example I was using a bit ago, but I think I will just bypass it. I think I've made the point otherwise on an arranged marriage where two fathers foist their opinions on two young people. So I think we'll move on to the discussion a bit more as to what, since courtship can be something other than godly, what does godly courtship look like? What are the characteristics of godly courtship as you would see it? There are a number of them. One of the first things Daryl brought up in the devotions already. What is one of the most important things we do when it comes to seeking a partner? Prayer. Involving God. It is an effort to find God's will, or God's direction, I should say, for our lives. And maybe I'll just make a comment here that I will invite others of you to feed in to help balance in any way that we can. But I remember as a young fellow, two of us were discussing the question about does God have a specific person that he wants you to get married to, and can it only be that person? And I remember saying, well, I hope there's not two, a little glibly. I have since come to feel this way about it. That, first of all, I fully believe that God knows who you are going to marry. That I have no question about. Does God have only one person that you can live with in mind? Will you be forever outside of his will if you don't happen to find just the right one? You see, it can take us in circles that I think, while a life's companion is an extremely important decision to make, I think we ought to also remember that it is in some ways like other decisions in life. We make the best choices that we know to make with the information we have and with what we know. Because if you get married thinking that this is the only one that God would have you get married to, and you find out afterwards that marriage isn't what you quite expected it would be, you know what the temptation is? I must have missed God's will. And hence I would subscribe more to this idea that we consult our parents. We consult, obviously consult the Lord. That we find the Lord's direction and then build on what he gives us. Because I will assure you that no courtship, no marriage has ever been perfect. Isaac and Rebecca, that must have been a perfect setup, wasn't it? It must have been God's will. But those poor folks struggled over who they liked best in their home. She liked Jacob better. He liked Esau better. What happened? Someplace they made some bad choices. And so we build on the choices. We build on what God gives us. I would just remind you of this, that I don't think that I have seen very many courtships or been involved in very many courtships where I haven't heard people say it's a little different than I thought. It's not quite what I thought it would be. And I would just say this to we're all given to some fantasy because when we don't know something for sure, we've got good imaginations. And so we will sometimes concoct ideas and pictures of how things could be and how things might be and for sure how they will be for us, only to find out later that we're not God, we didn't know everything after all. And so it's wise to go into both courtship and marriage with that awareness that you make the best decisions you know with the directions you have, and then you build on them. Now, Dave. That's right. Well, what are some other things that make a courtship godly?
Two people seeking God.
Okay, two people seeking God. Very good. What about your perspective about the opposite gender? Does God have a perspective on that? I mean, is there a right and a wrong perspective to have? There certainly is. Because you can imagine a spouse being for you, doing for you certain kinds of things that serve you. Well, the scriptures make it abundantly clear that in Ephesians 5 in particular, where it speaks about husbands and wives loving husbands loving, wives submitting, husbands loving, wives reverencing, make it very clear that there is a whole lot of death that happens in marriage. There's a whole lot of giving. And so to develop a perspective on what God has in what, I should say it this way, developing the perspective that God has about what you want, what you ought to have in a spouse is crucial, I believe, if your courtship is to be godly. What else? Sam.
You don't have to know and decide just how your companion is going to have to be. You can work that out as time goes on.
That reminds me, Sam, of the whole concept that love is not, or our love is not dependent on the performance of the object, but it depends on the attitude of the giver. And that's you're right. Simply allowing room for growth in that and developing that. Something else that I think is, yes, Gary. Exactly. We serve as strings to kites for each other in many cases. We offer each other things that we provide for the other, things that allow them to accomplish things they wouldn't accomplish without us. And I certainly feel that in my situation with Susanna. Another thing that I think is an important part of a godly courtship is upholding and living out godly principles of purity and holiness. And I can't tell you enough, young people, how important that is and how valuable that is. And I'll touch on that just a little bit later. There's yet one other thing that probably we're thinking about beginning courtship, and so we... So this one maybe doesn't sound like it should come quite this quickly, but our view of children is something else. I realize when you start dating, typically you are not thinking about having a family right away. But it's not too early to develop a proper perspective on God's perspective on children. And because unless people are willing to embrace that gift from God, then they aren't ready for marriage. And if they're not ready for marriage, maybe they're not ready for courtship either. You see how I'm sort of pedaling backwards here? I'm simply saying that now is the time to develop a concept of who children are in God's eyes. I see time is fleeting here, and I do need to draw this to a close soon. One of the things that I'd like to come back a bit to some of the questions that we ask about what is marriage like. I'd like to tell you just a quick story given by a man named Ravi Zacharias. Many of you would recognize the name. If you've heard his tape on, or his message on I Isaac Take Thee Rebecca, you'll recognize the story. But Ravi and his family moved to America sometime when they were fairly young, is my impression. And as they grew older, his brother had always said that when he gets married, he wants to marry an Indian wife. And so the time came when he was about, I think, 23 or 4, maybe he was 25 or 60. Typically, Indian men are older when they get married. And so he gets his father involved, and his father does the part of the father, and he writes to relatives in India and tells them what kind of a girl they're looking for. So they had, like, I think they came up with about 10 possibilities. And they'd send pictures and descriptions of these ladies. And as time went on, his brother would sit up at night and he'd look at these pictures, he'd read the descriptions, and he kept working this down by the process of elimination. Finally came down and he would ask Ravi, "What do you think of this one? You know, what do you think she looks good?" Or whatever all he asked. But it was all a process. Finally he got it figured out which one he wants to marry. Wedding date. And 2 weeks before the wedding, his brother flies to India. Before he goes, now he never met this woman. He had never met her family. He knew nothing more about her except what the paper said and what the picture said. And pictures don't lie, you know. And Ravi said, "I have one question that I want to ask you before you go. You know, what are you going to do if you get to India and you find out that this woman is not what you thought she was? Or what's she going to do if she finds out that you're not what she thought you were? What are you going to do with that?" And then his older brother rather patronizingly told him that marriage is more choice than it is feeling. And unless we get a hold of that concept, unless we get a hold of that principle, life can get really confusing. This man, this brother, has been married for many years and runs a business in England, I believe it is, and has done well and has a beautiful family. I'm not suggesting, friends, that we use that method. I really am not. But let me say this, that if that was bathed in prayer, that really wasn't so different than Isaac and Rebecca, was it? In fact, he had more input than Isaac did. And so before we get too critical of other people's ways of doing things, I think we ought to face the fact that when God is in it, and we put ourselves, and God has our will, God has our sovereignty, and we enter into His will, and we build the best that we know how, God blesses that. God honors that. And there's probably never been a marriage where people didn't simply have to stop and realize that this is not about just how good I feel. This is about being a man of integrity, a woman of integrity, doing what I said I would when I took the pledge, when I covenanted to live with my wife. One of the things that I'd just like to touch on is the question about standards. And I know that there are different ideas out there. I will simply tell you from my perspective that, like, let me tell you what a father told his son who was asking questions about, well, how involved can I get physically with my fiancé? That father wisely told his son this, that you will never regret any restraint that you practice. And that father meant any. And I, Suzanne and I were blessed. We may have been puritanical in our approach to things. We were very careful that our dating happened in a lighted living room. We took our first walk in the moonlight after we were married. And I know that that may sound like there was something wrong above my shoulders. But the truth of the matter is, there is, we just did everything we could to safeguard. And we live with no regrets for having done that. And I'd like to assure you that it is possible. And I'd like to encourage you in that. One of the things that Rabbi Zacharias said is this, and this has to do with standards. It has to do with what we talked about earlier about the sovereignty that God gives every one of us. There are all kinds of relationships that we have. There are parent-child relationships. There are sibling relationships. There are relationships within a brotherhood. There are pastor-lay relationships. You can name a lot of different kinds of relationships. But there is only one relationship that God has intended that has physical consummation, and that's marriage. And any time that is breached, any time that physical consummation is realized outside of marriage, there is then that violation of that sovereignty of each other. And I'm simply urging us to take that very, very seriously. Now, that may not be the best note to close on. But I would just like to, again, there are other ways that we do that, but I'm just saying that physical involvement can very quickly intrude on another person's God likeness, his sovereignty that God has given him. You want to hear the story yet about Chauhan and his marriage? I'll tell you that yet, because I found it interesting, because I went to India sort of thinking that they must have it together, because they can pull off these arranged marriages. Well, Chauhan's story helped me realize it isn't just like we think necessarily, although it is that way sometimes, where fathers get together and they agree that it's going to be this way. And the young people live with it and die with it, I guess, eventually. But in spite of the fact that Chauhan had sort of a combination of a love arranged marriage, he told me about a custom that they have in India that let me tell you the story, and then you'll see why it was a little revolting to me. He said that in India, they have the custom of a feast for, it will probably vary from village to village, but after several days of feasting, this all happens in the bride's home. Finally, at the end of the feasting, the days of feasting, then it's time for the bride to go home, to go with the groom to his home. That's where they start living. That's where they start their life together, is in the groom's home. That is in his parental home. The custom is, though, it's a very difficult transition, and they make a lot of it. To transfer this transition from the bride's home to the groom's home. So the evening of their wedding, the evening now, the feasting was over, now it was time to go home, it was time for him to take his bride home with him. She began to cry, because she doesn't want to leave her mom. And this goes on. And I don't know how long the process lasts, but it's almost ceremonious, I understand. And after a certain amount of weeping, guess whose job it is to go rescue this bride, take her out of the arms of her mother, to go home with her groom? None other than the new mother-in-law. Did that happen in your case, I asked Chohan? Yes, it did. He said, Surabhi was crying, she didn't want to go with me. Finally, my mom went and she got her, and she brought her with me. Now, I thought you'd be interested in this story because you know a little about Chohan. Now, let me say this in all fairness. Chohan and Surabhi, as far as I know, have a good relationship. They, in fact, complement each other very well. And so how much of that was custom and how much of it was sincerity, I don't know. But I do say that I have a lot of appreciation for the way that we do things in our tradition, in our culture. Let's, as we commit ourselves to a godly courtship, remember that God has created us as individuals, and there are certain things that He reserves only for married people. And again, you will never regret any restraint that you practice. May God bless you.